rifle.
Can I go over?
Why not?
Yes. There's the chapter that I contributed to the book. I would say it's about citizens' engagement in the government process rather than citizens. It's not the right way to think about it. It's really about the kinds of democracy, whether we have it or not, the struggles to make it a bit more real. I think whether we think we need representative democracy or direct democracy or a bit of each, you need a very sophisticated public understanding issues and able to articulate arguments to take effective part in metropolitan scale planning. But what I want to say now is really in response to a remark made at this meeting last week by Ian Gordon, talking about scenarios in London planning. He said one of the things we really need is the articulation of a wider variety of narratives, other stories about London. So what I want to do is to just do another story about London. And it has four main bits. So this is, if you like, another way of seeing the situation that we are in. First of all, a long trend starting in the late 70s for the share of wages in GDP to decline. In the UK, in every single one of the other EU original member states, and in North America, and shares of profits and rent increasing. So that's in a way, in a quiet, long-term kind of way, it's a sort of class struggle view of the history of the world in the last decade. Second point, that in order that consumption could continue to grow, while the wages share stayed rather flat or falling, the growth of credit is absolutely crucial. Credit is what allows everyone to go on a series of things, including not least university staff, who I must say, being grossly underpaid, who managed to run up huge debts and then remortgage their houses like everybody else, and pay off the debts and end up on retirement day like me. Okay. Yeah, some of us are not very well this, but debt has been enormously important. Thirdly, the very strong growth of income inequality, wealth inequality within most countries, and the UK playing a really leading role in this. Growth of inequalities in the UK, whether you make it in many different ways, is extremely severe. Fourthly, that flows of surpluses in the world, flows of money capital floating around, looking for things to be invested in, has gone in different directions in different parts of the world. It's gone into production in some places, it's gone into natural resource extraction in Africa and Australia and so on. In Europe, and very strongly in the UK, it's gone into assets. Land, property, money being placed into the fields where it is expected to produce rising asset prices. What economists often call rent-seeking behavior. And of course that's a self-fulfilling prophecy up to a point, because if more money flows into chasing these assets, especially if they're scarce, the more self-fulfilling that is, because up go the asset prices. What you wanted as an investment. But in our case, we have a problem that we have a whole real estate development sector which is very expert at what it's good at is exploiting the potentialities of these capital value growth processes in the real estate market in a very constrained situation where it plays a part in creating its scarcity. So the UK, and especially London and the South East, have really suffered incredibly badly from all these processes. Extremely strong polarisation. Incomes So, I guess that narrative, that story, doesn't really see the crisis of the last few years primarily as a crisis. I mean, clearly that was what got triggered, but it sees it as another moment in that long struggle about weakness and social problem. And I think the way I would see the current period is that now, on top of all that, low and middle income people in London are going to be hit by huge cuts in the social wage. These cuts in public authority services, national welfare regimes, disappearance of services on which people rely, not to mention the jobs in the public services on which people employ. All of that is going to hit incredibly hard. People in not just the bottom, but the middle of the income distribution. So, some of us are extremely depressed and expensive. Now, keeping that kind of rather leftish perspective alive over these last decades has been incredibly difficult. Often it feels like being one of those characters in Fahrenheit 451, walking along through the forest, memorising old books and telling their children so that old knowledge, which is now forbidden, will be transmitted to the next generation. It doesn't feel quite so bad now, because clearly the world is in absolutely ghastly mess and is more receptive to credible ways of thinking about it. So I think that's the background. But the London clowns, Ken's and Boris's, both grounded in a particular narrative about London, onwards and upwards, wonderful global city, let's make it as exemplary as possible. And we do love it, as very ambivalent about capitalism, it produces wonderful things, including wonderful cities. But there are really radically different points of view about how it is and how it ought to go. And it's been difficult to keep these ways of thinking alive in universities too. I think it's to the credit of the LSE that's keeping debate going about really important fundamental things. Now, what I'm really writing about in that chapter of the book is attempts since the year 2000 by varying configurations of community groups, NGOs, campaign groups, Tenants Federation of London, Friends of the Earth, some green, some red organisations, basically, to try and present and coordinate and articulate counterviews to the prevailing orthodoxy. I think it's an interesting story. I don't suppose we should win any great changes after Mrs. Johnson as a result of hearing a great deal of this London Plan EIP which has just ended. But I don't think we went primarily for people who came to the plan. We mainly went because we thought that the voices of the other half of the population should be heard. We've been very successful in getting a lot of voices around the table to express these views. And I hope that we might just get some dents in the plan, because it has some incredibly serious contradictions, and I just want to mention four, and then I'll shut up. The first is, at the beginning of the London Plan, new version, the mayor talks about the need for a step change in the way the city works to deal with the environmental problems. But then when you read the plan, there really are no step changes. There are a few nice phrases, really concrete measures about environmental issues and carbon and so on are softer than they used to be. There's really nothing there to do with all that. Interestingly, nobody mentioned anything environmental at the LSE seminar last week on scenarios for London. That was interesting too. It's ceased to be an issue in lots of circles, I think, because economic questions have become more of an issue. Second thing is about poverty and equality. The mayor expresses fine aspirations about tackling poverty, especially in relation to health inequalities, on which there's some very good work in the GLA and the plan. But in fact, the plan is relentlessly driven by the pursuit of aggregate GDP, growth, simple growth. The problem of low wages in London, which is an extremely serious problem, is noted. But apart from the mayor supporting the London Living Wage Company,
which was picked up and continued with the front gap. There really is nothing on this front help. It's a lot in the plan about productivity, but it's all about how important it is to continue to grow the high productivity sectors, the finance and business services sectors, which have such high productivity, given the way we measure this stuff. Nothing about how you raise the productivity of people at the bottom of this, how you raise the productivity of people in retail, in cleaning, and health services, and social care, which is where the low wages is and the low productivity. Mainly because we have crazy ways of measuring the output of those sectors and statistics. So this is an extremely unsatisfactory country to be able to play. Thirdly and lastly, on housing. The plan is structured in such a way that the discussion on housing was almost entirely about what targets should be set for total output of housing. Total output of housing. And then questions of tenure and price and affordability were very much treated as a secondary matter to be dealt with either as a percentage of the total or perhaps the numbers. Now this is completely mistaken because total housing includes all the housing in the open market and you don't know where it's going. I mean, you have no control, of course you have no control over where it's going. It's an open market. Some of it is an investment for people who are going to be empty. Some of it is an investment for people who are going to rent it out from lets. Some of it are going to second homes or third homes, which is fine, that's what free markets are about. But the amount of it will be available at the prices people can afford to meet any needs is almost impossible to predict, and therefore very difficult to put it up. And all the government announcements since the election on housing issues further add to the really crucial importance of having more social rented housing. And if we can't get that contradiction acknowledged in the inspector's report, I think all those fine words about qualities will need to be taken out of it, or it won't be a internally consistent.